It's a solid portrait of kids, a little older than me, but they're kids. Don't fight me on that. Too young to be worried about shit like death cast alerts. They know their day is going to end like it usually does.
Good move, Mateo says.
I got one last ride out of it. I'm set. I take more photos. The ongoing handball match. The monkey bars where we play gladiator. The long yellow slide, the swings. Come. I almost go back for my bike before remembering I've just given it up. I feel lighter. Like my shadow just quit his day job, walked off, and threw up a peace sign. Mateo follows me to the swings.
You said you'd come here with your dad, right? Naming clouds and shit? Let's swing.
Mateo sits on the swing, holds on for dear life. I know. Takes a few steps and propels forward, his legs looking like they're about to kick over a building. I get a picture before joining him on the swing. My arms wrapped around the chains, I manage to take some pictures. Puts me and my phone at risk again, I know. But for every four blurry shots, I snap a good one. Mateo points out the dark nimbus clouds, and I'm straight wowed I get to live in this moment with someone who doesn't deserve to die. It'll storm again soon, but for now we go back and forth, and I wonder if he's thinking two deckers sharing swings might mean the entire thing will collapse and kill us, or if we'll swing so high we'll fly and fall out of life. But I feel safe. We slow down and I shout to him, "The Pluto's gotta scatter me here."
"Your place of change,"
Mateo shouts while the swing throws him backward. "Any other big changes today, besides the obvious?"
"Yeah."
"What?" I smile over at him as our swinging comes to a stop. "I gave up my bike." I know what he's really asking, but I don't take the bait. He's got to make a move himself. I'm not robbing him of that moment. It's too big. I stay seated as he stands. Weird how this is the last time I'll be in this park, with flesh and a heart that works. Mateo looks around. It's his last time here, too.
You ever hear about those deckers who turn into trees?
Sounds like a fairy tale, I know.
The Living Urn offers deckers the opportunity to have their ashes put in a biodegradable urn containing a tree seed that absorbs nutrients and stuff from their ashes. Which I thought was fantasy, but nope. It's science.
Maybe instead of having my ashes just scattered on the ground some dog is going to shit on, I could live on as a tree?
Yeah. And other teens will carve hearts into you, and you can produce oxygen.
People like air, Mateo says. It's drizzling, so I get up from the swing, the chain rattling behind me. Let's get somewhere dry, weirdo. Coming back as a tree would be pretty chill. Like I'm growing up in Althea Park again. Not that I'll say that out loud, 'cause yo, you can't go around telling people you want to be a tree and expect them to take you seriously.
Damian Rivas, 2:22 p.m. Deathcast did not call Damian Rivas because he isn't dying today, which he considers a shame because he's not very impressed with the way he's been living his life lately. Damian has always been an adrenaline junkie. New roller coasters every summer he met the required height, stealing candy from drugstores and cash from his father's pouch, fighting those who are the Goliath to his David, starting a gang. Playing a game of darts against himself isn't exactly thrilling. Talking to Peck on the phone isn't exciting either. "Calling the cops is some little bitch shit," Damian says, loud enough for his speakerphone. "Getting me to call the cops goes against everything I stand for." "I know, you only like the cops when they're called on you," Peck says. Damien nods like Peck can see him. We should have handled that ourselves. You're right, Peck says. The cops never even got Rufus. They're probably giving up because he's a Decker. Let's get you some justice, Damien says. Excitement and purpose surge through him. He's been living away from the edge all summer, and now he's inching closer and closer to his favorite place in the world. He imagines Rufus's face where the dartboard is. He throws the dart and hits Bullseye, right between Rufus's eyes.
Mateo, 2:34 p.m. It's raining again, harder than back at the cemetery. I feel like the bird I looked after as a kid, the one pummeled by the rain, the one that left its nest before it was ready. We should go inside, I say. Scared of catching a cold? Scared of becoming a statistic who gets struck by lightning? We hang out underneath the awning of this pet store, puppies in the window distracting us from figuring out our next move. I have an idea to honor your explorer side. Maybe we can ride the train back and forth. There's so much I never got to see in my own city. Maybe we'll stumble into something awesome. Forget it. That's stupid. That's not stupid at all. I know exactly what you're talking about. Rufus leads the way to a nearby subway station. Our city is gigantic, too. Someone can live here their entire life and never walk every block in every borough. I once dreamt I was on some intense cycling trip where my tires had this glow-in-the-dark paint on them, and I was aiming to make the city light up by midnight. I smile. Did you succeed? There's actual race-against-the-clock suspense in this dream. Nah, I think I started dreaming about sex or something and woke up from that, Rufus says. He's probably not a virgin, but I don't ask because it's not my business. We're heading back downtown. Who knows how far we'll go. Maybe we'll ride the train until the very last stop, catch a bus, ride that to an even farther stop. Maybe we'll end up in another state, like New Jersey. There's a train, door open, at the platform, and we run into it, finding an empty bench in the corner. Let's play a game, Rufus says. Not Gladiator again. Rufus shakes his head. Nope. It's a game called Traveler I used to play with Olivia. Make up a story about another passenger, where they're going and who they are. He shifts, his body leaning against mine as he discreetly points at a woman in blue medical scrubs under her jacket, holding a shopping bag. She's going home to take a nap, and then blast some pop music as she gets ready for her first day off in 9 days. She doesn't know it yet, but her favorite bar is going to be closed for renovations. That sucks, I say. Rufus turns to me, his wrist spinning, encouraging me to go on. Oh, she'll go back home, where she'll find her favorite movie on some cable network and catch up on emails to her friends during commercial breaks. He grins. What? She started her evening fairly adventurous, he says. She was taking a nap, so she had energy to party all night. I figured she'd want to see what her friends are up to. She probably misses text messages and phone calls since she's usually too busy saving lives and delivering babies. She needs this, believe me. I nod at a girl with headphones bigger than fists and hair dyed platinum. She's drawing something colorful on her tablet with a blue stylus. I nod toward her. She got the tablet for her birthday last week, and she really wanted it for games and video chatting with her friends. But she discovered this design app and experimented with it when she was bored. It's her new obsession. I like that, Rufus says. The train stops and the girl is scrambling to get her illustrated tote bag together. She runs out of the car right when the doors are closing, like an action movie sequence. And now she's going home where she'll be late for a video chat with her friends because she's too busy getting this one idea right. We keep playing Traveler. Rufus points out a girl with a suitcase who he thinks is running away, but I correct him. She's actually returning home after a big fight with her sister, and they're going to repair their relationship. I mean, anyone with eyes can see that's what's happening. Another passenger, soaked, was having car trouble and had to ditch his van. No, wait, his Mercedes, Rufus corrects, because a train ride is a humbling experience for this rich guy. Some NYU students jump on the train with umbrellas by their sides, possibly coming from orientation. Their whole lives ahead of them. And we play a flash round predicting who they'll become. A family court judge and a family of artists. A comedian in Los Angeles, where they'll appreciate her traffic jokes. A talent agent who won't make it big for a few years, but will have her time to shine. A screenwriter for a children's TV show about monsters playing sports. A skydiving instructor, which is funny because he has this handlebar mustache that must look like it's smiling against the wind during every descent. If someone else were playing Traveler, what would they predict for me and Rufus? Rufus taps my shoulder, pointing at the exit as the doors open. Hey, isn't this the stop where we spontaneously got our gym memberships? Huh? Yeah, it is. You wanted to be brolic after some dick bumped into you at the Bleachers concert, Rufus says, right when the doors close. I haven't been to a Bleachers concert, but I get the game now. Wrong night, Rufus. The dude bumped into me at the Fun concert. Hey, this is the stop where we got tattoos. Yeah, the tattoo artist, Barkley Baker, I correct. Remember? Baker, the tattoo artist who quit medical school? Right. We caught Baker in a good mood and he gave us a buy one, get one free deal. I got the bike tire on my forearm. He taps his arm. And you got a male seahorse. Rufus looks so confused, like he might call time out to see if we're still playing the same game. Remind me why you got that one again? My dad is really into male seahorses. He carried me through life solo, remember? I can't believe you forgot the meaning of the seahorse tattoo on my shoulder. No, wrist. Yeah, it's on my wrist. That's cooler. I can't believe you forgot where your tattoo is. When we get to the next stop, Rufus throws us into the future. Hey, this is where I normally get off for work. When I'm in the office, at least. And not in whatever resort around the world they send me to for review. It's wild I get to work in a building you designed and built. So wild, Rufus. I look down at where my seahorse tattoo should be. In the future, Rufus is a travel blogger and I'm an architect. We have tattoos we got together. We've gone to so many concerts he can't keep them straight in his head. I almost wish we weren't so creative in this moment, because these fake memories of friendship feel incredible. Imagine that, reliving something you never lived. We have to leave our mark, I say, getting up from my seat. We going outside to piss on fire hydrants? I put the blind date book on the seat. I don't know who will find this, but isn't it cool knowing someone will if we leave it here? It's true. This is prime seating, Rufus says, getting up from the bench. The train stops and the doors open. There has to be more to life than imagining a future for yourself. I can't just wish for the future. I have to take risks to create it. There's something I really want to do, I say. We out, Rufus says, smiling. We get off the train before the doors close, almost bumping into two girls, and we take off out of the subway.
Zoe Landon, 2:57 p.m. Deathcast called Zoe Landon at 12:34 a.m. to tell her she's going to die today. Zoe was lonely, having only moved to New York 8 days ago to begin classes at NYU today. She's barely unpacked her boxes, let alone made friends yet. But thankfully, the last friend app was one click away. Her first message went to this boy, Mateo, but he never responded. Maybe he died. Maybe he ignored her message. Maybe he found a last friend, like Zoe ultimately did. Zoe and Gabriella get on the train right before the doors close, dodging two boys to do so. They rush to the bench in the corner, halting when they see a paper-wrapped object sitting there. Rectangular. Every time Zoe enters the subway, there are all these signs encouraging her to say something if she sees something. She's seeing something. "This is bad," Zoe says. "You should get off at the next stop." Gabriella, fearless because she didn't receive the alert today, picks up the object. Zoe flinches. "It's a book," Gabriella says. "Oh, it's a surprise book." She sits and eyes the illustration of a fleeing criminal. "I love this art." Zoe sits next to her. She thinks the drawing is cute, but respects Gabriella's opinion. "It's my turn to tell you a secret," Gabriella says, "if you want." Zoe shared all her secrets today with Gabriella, all the secrets she made her childhood best friends, Pinky, swear to never tell another soul, all the heartbreaking ones she always kept to herself because speaking up was too hard. Together, the two have laughed and cried as if they've been best friends their entire lives. "Your secret dies with me," Zoe says. She doesn't laugh, and neither does Gabriella, but she squeezes her hand to let her know she's going to be okay. A promise based on nothing but a gut instinct. Screw evidence of the afterlife. "It's not a huge secret, but I'm Batman of the Manhattan graffiti world," Gabriella says. "Aw, you had me really excited. Batman of the Manhattan graffiti world," Zoe says. "I specialize in graffiti pushing last friends. In some places I'll draw with marker, like on menus and train posters, but my true love is graffiti. I've done tags for the last friends I've met, anywhere I can. In the past week, I've covered walls with the cute silhouettes from the app by McDonald's, two hospitals, and a soup spot. I hope everyone uses it." Gabriella taps her fingers against the book. At first look, Zoe thought the colors around her nails was a polish job gone terribly wrong, but she knows the truth now. "Anyway, I love art, and I will tag a mailbox or something with your name. Maybe somewhere on the Broadway Strip? I won't ever have my name in lights, but it'll be there," Zoe says. She pictures her request now. Her heart is full and empty at the thought. Passengers look up from their newspapers and phone games and stare at Zoe. Indifference on one's face, pity on another's. Pure sadness from a black woman with this gorgeous afro. "Sorry to lose you," the woman says. "Thank you," Zoe says. The woman returns to her phone. Zoe scoots closer to Gabriella. "I feel like I made this weird," she says, her voice quieter than before. "Speak up while you can," Gabriella says. "Let's see what that book is," Zoe says. She's curious. "Open it." Gabriella hands Zoe the book. "You open it. It's my end day, not my birthday," Zoe says. "I don't need a gift, and I'm not exactly going to read the book in the next." Zoe checks her watch and feels dizzy. She has at most 9 hours left, and she's a very slow reader. "Consider this gift left behind by someone else my gift to you. Thanks for being my last friend." The woman across looks up, Her eyes widen. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'm just really happy to hear your last friends. I'm happy you found someone on your end day. She gestures to Gabriella, and that you're helping make days full. It's beautiful. Gabriella wraps an arm around Zoe's shoulders and pulls her close. The two thank the woman. Of course, Zoe meets the most welcoming New Yorkers on her end day. Let's open it together, Gabriella says, returning their attention to the book. Deal, Zoe says. Zoe hopes Gabriella continues befriending Deckers when she can. Life isn't meant to be lived alone. Neither are end days.
Mateo, 3:18 p.m. Seeing Lydia will be a huge risk, but it's one I want to take. The bus pulls up, and we allow everyone else to get on first before boarding. I ask the bus driver if he received the alert today, and he shakes his head. This ride should be safe. We can still die on the bus, yeah, but the odds of the bus being completely totaled and killing us while leaving everyone else severely injured seem pretty low. I borrow Rufus's phone so I can call Lydia. My phone's battery is dying, down close to 30%, and I want to make sure the hospital can reach me in case my dad wakes up. I move to a different seat near the back of the bus and dial Lydia's number. Lydia picks up almost instantly, but there's still this pause before she answers, a lot like in the weeks after Christian died.
Hello?
Hi, I say.
Mateo!
I'm sorry, I...
You blocked my number! I taught you how to do that!
I had to...
How could you not tell me?
I...
Mateo, I'm your fucking best fucking friend!
Penny, don't listen to Mommy.
And you don't fucking tell me you're dying?
I didn't want...
Shut up! Are you okay? How are you doing?
I've always thought Lydia is like a coin being flipped in the air. Tails is when she's so pissed it's like she's turning her back on you. And heads is when she sees you at her clearest. I think we've landed on heads, but who knows? I'm okay, Lydia. I'm with a friend. A new friend, I say.
Who is this? How'd you meet her?
The last friend app, I say. His name is Rufus. He's a Decker, too.
I want to see you.
Me too. That's why I'm calling. Any chance you could drop off Penny somewhere and meet me at the Travel Arena?
Abuelita is already here.
I called her, freaking the fuck out, hours ago, and she came home from work. I'll go to the arena right now, but please get there safely. Don't run. Walk slowly, except when you're crossing the street. Only cross when it's your light, and only when there isn't a car in sight, even if they're stopped at a red light or parked along the sidewalk.
Actually, do not move. Where are you right now? I'm coming for you. Do not move unless someone around you looks shady.
I'm on a bus with Rufus already, I say.
Two Deckers on one bus? Do you have a death wish? Mateo, those odds are insane! That thing could topple over!
My face burns a little. I don't have a death wish, I quietly say.
I'm sorry. I'm shutting up. Please be careful. I have to see you one last... I have to see you, okay?
You'll see me and I'll see you. I promise.
I don't want to hang up, she says.
Me either. We don't hang up. We could, and should, probably use this time to talk about memories or find things to apologize for in case I can't keep my promise. But nope. We talk about how Penny just hit herself on the head with a big toy and isn't crying, like the little soldier she is. A new memory to laugh over is just as good as reflecting on an old one, I think. It may even be better. I don't want to kill Rufus's phone battery in case the Plutos reach out, so Lydia and I agree to hang up at the same time. Pressing end kills my mood, and the world feels heavier again.
Peck, 3:21 p.m. Peck is getting the gang back together, the gang with no name. Peck got his nickname because there's no power behind his punches. More annoying than harmful, like a bird pecking on you. If you want someone laid out, stick the knockout king on them. Peck is good with stomping someone out if the occasion calls for it, but Damien and Kendrick don't keep him around because he's an extra body. Peck's access to an end-all weapon makes him valuable. He walks toward his closet, feeling Damien's and Kendrick's eyes on his back. From here on, it's like a Russian nesting doll, designed that way by Peck. He opens the closet, wondering if he has it in him. He opens the hamper, wondering if he's okay never seeing Amy again, knowing she'll never forgive him if she ever finds out he's responsible. He opens the last box, a shoebox, knowing he's got to respect himself for once. Peck will gain respect by unloading this gun into the one who disrespected him. "What we do now?" Damien asks. Peck opens up Instagram, goes on Rufus's profile, and is pissed to find more comments from Amy saying how much she misses him. He keeps refreshing the account over and over. We wait.
Mateo, 3:26 p.m. The rain turns to drizzle when the bus stops outside the World Travel Arena at 30th and 12th. I step off the bus first, and behind me there's a squeak, and fuck! I turn in time to grab onto the steps railing so Rufus doesn't fall face first out of the bus and take me with him. He's a little muscular, so the weight hurts my shoulders, but Rufus helps situate us both. Wet floor, Rufus says. My bad. We're here. We're safe. We have each other's back. We'll stretch this day out as long as possible, like we're the summer solstice. The travel arena has always reminded me of the Museum of Natural History, except half as big and with international flags fixed along the edges of the dome. The Hudson River is a couple blocks away, which I don't point out to Rufus. The maximum capacity of the arena is 3,000 people, which is more than perfect for Deckers, their guests, those with incurable diseases, and anyone else looking to enjoy the experience. We decide to get our tickets while waiting for Lydia. A staff member assists us. The three lines are organized by urgency, as in, those with sicknesses versus those of us dying today by some unknown force versus bored visitors. It's easy figuring out our line with one look at the others. The line to our right is full of laughter, selfies, texting. The line to our left has none of that. There's a young woman with a scarf wrapped around her head, leaning against her oxygen tank. Others are wheezing terribly. Some are disfigured or badly burned. The sadness chokes me, not only for them, and not even for myself, but for the others ahead of us in our line who were woken up from their safe lives and will hurtle into danger in the next few hours, maybe even minutes. And then there are those who never got this far in the day. Why can't we have a chance? I ask Rufus. A chance at what? He's looking around, taking pictures of the arena and the lines. A chance at another chance, I say. Why can't we knock on death's door and beg or barter or arm wrestle or have a staring contest for the chance to keep living? I'd even want to fight for the chance to decide how I die. I'd go in my sleep. And I would only go to sleep after I lived bravely, as the kind of person someone would want to wrap their arm around, who would maybe even nuzzle against my chin or shoulder, and go on and on about how happy we were to be alive with each other without question. Rufus lowers his phone and looks me in the eyes. You really think you can beat death in an arm wrestling match? I laugh and look away from him because the eye contact is warming my face. An Uber pulls up, and Lydia storms out of the back seat. She's frantically looking around for me, and even though today isn't her end day, I'm still nervous when a bike rider almost clips her, like he'll knock her unconscious and she'll find herself in the hospital with Dad. Lydia! I run out of line as her eyes find me. I almost trip in my excitement, like I haven't seen her in years. She throws her arms around me and squeezes, almost as if she herself has pulled me out of a sinking car or caught me after I've fallen out of a crashing plane. She says everything in this hug. Every thank you, every I love you, every apology. I squeeze her back to thank her, to make her feel my love, to apologize, and everything else that falls deep inside and skirts outside these realms. It's the sweetest moment in our friendship since she handed me Penny as a newborn. Lydia steps back and slaps me hard across the face.
You should have told me!
Lydia pulls me back into another hug. My cheek stings, but I dig my chin into her shoulder, and she smells like whatever cinnamon thing she must have fed Penny today because she hasn't changed out of the baggy shirt I last saw her in. In our hug, we sway, and I search for Rufus in line, and he's clearly shocked by the slap. It's weird how Rufus doesn't know this is Lydia at her core, how, like I said, she's a coin constantly flipping. It's strange how I've only known Rufus for a day. I know, I tell Lydia. You know I'm sorry, and I was only trying to protect you.
You're supposed to be with me forever,
Lydia cries.
You're supposed to be around to play bad cop when Penny brings a crush home for the first time. You're supposed to keep me company with card games and bad TV marathons when she leaves for college. You're supposed to be around to vote for Penny to become president, because you know she's such a control freak already that she won't be happy until she's ruling the country. God knows she'll sell her soul to take over the whole world, and you're supposed to be there to help me stop her from making Faustian deals.
I don't know what to say. I go back and forth between nodding and shaking my head because I don't know what to do. I'm sorry.
It's not your fault.
Lydia squeezes my shoulder. Maybe it is. Maybe if I wasn't hiding, I'd have street smarts or something. It's early to be blaming myself, but maybe it's going to be my fault, Lydia. This day has sort of felt like being thrust out into the wilderness with all the supplies I'd need to survive, and no idea how to even make a fire.
Shut your face, Lydia demands. This is not your fault. We failed you.
Now you shut your face.
That's the rudest thing you've ever said,
Lydia says with a smile, like I've had promised to be mean all along.
The world isn't the safest place ever. We know that because of Christian and everyone else dying on the daily. But I should have shown you some risks are worth it.
Sometimes you have a child who you love more than anything, unexpectedly. This was one way she showed me. I'm taking risks today, I say. And I want you here because it's so much harder for you to break out and be adventurous with Penny in your life. You've always wanted to see the world, and since we're not going to get a chance in this lifetime to go on road trips, I'm happy we can travel together right now. I hold her hand. I nod toward Rufus. Lydia turns to Rufus with the same nervous face she had when we were sitting in her bathroom with her pregnancy test. And just like then, before she flipped over the stick to see the result, she says,
"Let's do this."
She squeezes my hand, which Rufus focuses on. "Hey, what's up?" Rufus asks.
"Better days, obviously,"
Lydia says.
"This fucking sucks. I'm so sorry."
"Not your fault," Rufus says. Lydia stares at me like she's still surprised I'm in front of her. We reach the front of the line. The teller, dressed in a cheerful yellow vest, solemnly smiles. "Welcome to the World Travel Arena. Sorry to lose you three."
"I'm not dying," Lydia corrects.
Oh, cost for guests is going to be $100, the teller says. He looks at me and Rufus. Suggested donation is $1 for Deckers. I pay for all our tickets, donating an extra couple $100 in the hope that the arena remains open for many, many years. What the arena provides for Deckers seems incomparable, way better than the Make a Moment station. The teller thanks us for our donation and doesn't seem surprised by it. Deckers are always throwing their money around. Rufus and I receive yellow wristbands for healthy Deckers, and Lydia an orange one, visitor, and we proceed in. We stay close, not wandering too far from one another. The main entrance is a little crowded as Deckers and visitors look up at the gigantic screen listing all the regions you can visit and the different kinds of tours available. Around the world in 80 minutes, miles of wilds, journey to the center of the United States, and more. Should we go on a tour? Rufus asks. I'm game for any of them except you, me, and the deep blue sea. The Around the World in 80 Minutes tour starts in 10, I say.
I'd love that,
Lydia says, her arm locked in mine. She turns to Rufus, embarrassed.
Sorry, oh my God, sorry. Really, it's whatever you two want. I don't get a vote. Sorry.
It's okay, I say. Rufus, you cool with this?
Around the world we go, yo.
We find room 16 and settle into a double-decker trolley with 20 other people. Rufus and I are the only deckers with yellow wristbands. There are 6 deckers with blue wristbands. Online, I followed many deckers with incurable diseases who take it upon themselves to travel the real countries and cities while they still have time. But those who can't afford to do so settle for the next best thing with the rest of us. The driver stands in the aisle and speaks through her headset.
Good afternoon. Thank you for joining me on this wonderful tour, where we'll travel the world in 80 minutes, give or take 10. I'm Leslie, and I'll be your tour guide. On behalf of everyone at the World Travel Arena, I offer my condolences to you and your family. I hope our trip today manages to put a smile on your face and leaves a wonderful memory for any guests joining you. If at some point you'd like to linger in any region, you're more than welcome to. But please be advised the tour will have to keep moving if we're to finish traveling the world in under 80 minutes. Now, if everyone would please fasten your seat belts, we'll take off. Everyone buckles up and we set off. I'm no cartographer, but even I know the destination grid behind each seat, looking similar to the electronic maps on the subway, isn't geographically correct. Still, it's an unbelievable time with unbelievably convincing replicas in each room, made even better by Lydia sharing fun facts about each location she learned from her own studies. We move down a railway where we can see deckers and guests enjoying themselves, some even waving at us like we're not all tourists here. In London, we pass the Palace of Westminster, where a myth says it's illegal to die there. But my favorite part is hearing the bell of Big Ben chime, even if seeing the hands on the clock snaps me back into reality. In Jamaica, we're greeted by dozens of large butterflies, the giant swallowtail, as people sitting on the floor eat special dishes like ackee and saltfish. In Africa, we see a giant fish tank with inhabitants from Lake Malawi, and I'm so enraptured by the blues and yellows swimming around that I almost miss the live feed on the wall of a lioness carrying her cub by the scruff of its neck. In Cuba, we see guests competing against Cubans in dominoes, and a line for sugar cubes, and Rufus cheers for his roots. In Australia, there are exotic flowers, kite races, and complimentary koala plush toys for any children. In Iraq, the sounds of the national bird, the chukar partridge, play over the speakers discreetly hidden behind the merchant carts offering beautiful silk scarves and shirts. In Colombia, Lydia tells us about the country's perpetual summer,
and were tempted to grab a drink from the juice vendors. In Egypt, there are only 2 pyramid replicas, and since the room has a dry heat, the employees are offering Nile River brand water bottles. In China, Lydia jokes about how she heard reincarnation is forbidden here without government permission, and I don't want to think about that, so I focus on the lit-up skyscraper replicas and people playing table tennis. In South Korea, we see a couple of orange-yellow robots used in classrooms, robo-teachers they're called, and Deckers having their faces made up. In Puerto Rico, the trolley stops for its 40-second break. Rufus tugs at my arm and ushers me elsewhere, Lydia following. "What's going on?" I ask over the chorus of tiny tree frogs. It's unclear if they're actually here or just recordings. And the sounds of wildlife are so jarring, since I'm only used to sirens and cars honking, that hearing the people talking by the rum cart comforts me. "We talked about how you wanted to do something exhilarating if you ever had the chance to travel, right?" Rufus says. "I've been keeping an eye out for something on this tour. And look." He points at the sign by a tunnel. "Rainforest jump." "I don't know what it means, but it's got to be better than that fake skydive earlier."
"You went skydiving?"
Lydia asks. Her tone is both, "Are you crazy?" and "I'm super jealous." She's possessive in the most nurturing, big sister way possible. The three of us walk along the beige tiles, sprinklings of actual sand around, to the tunnel. An arena employee hands us a brochure for the El Yunque Rainforest Room and offers us an audio tour, while admitting we'll miss out on some of the more natural music of the area if we do. We pass on the headphones and walk through the tunnel, where the air is moist and warm. The crowding trees withstand the drizzle as an artificial sunlight filters through the thick leaves. We walk around the twisting trunks, going off the beaten path toward the trilling croaks of more tree frogs. Dad told me stories about how when he was my age, he'd race up the trees with his friends, catch frogs and sell them to other kids who wanted pets, and sometimes just sit with his thoughts. The deeper we go, the more the frog song is replaced by the sounds of people and a waterfall. I mistake the latter for a recording until we pass through a clearing, and I find water spilling off a 20-foot-high cliff into a pool with shirtless Deckers and lifeguards. This must be the advertised rainforest jump. Don't know why I thought it was going to be something lamer, like jumping from rock to rock on even ground. I've seen so much already that the idea of leaving this arena is sharper than that of this day ending, like being ripped out of a dream you've waited your entire life to have. But I'm not dreaming. I'm awake, and I'm going for it. "My daughter hates the rain," Lydia tells Rufus. "She hates anything she can't control." "She'll come around," I say. We walk toward the edge of the cliff where Deckers are jumping. A petite girl with a blue wristband, a headscarf, and floaties does something dangerous at the very last second. She turns around and falls backward, like someone pushed off a building. A lifeguard below whistles, and the others swim to the center where she's splashed through. She returns to the surface, laughing, and it looks like the lifeguards are scolding her, but she doesn't care. How could anyone on a day like today?
Rufus, 4:24 p.m. For all the mouth I ran about being brave, I'm not sure about this jump. I haven't set foot onto a beach or gone inside a community pool since my family died. The closest I've come to big bodies of water like this before today was when Amy was fishing in the East River. And that led to a nightmare of me fishing for my family's car in the Hudson River. Reeling up their skeletons in the clothes they died in, reminding me how I abandoned them. "You're all good to go here, Mateo. Gonna have to veto this for myself."
"You should skip this too," Lydia tells him. "I know I have no real say here, but veto, 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 veto."
Mad props to Mateo for getting in line anyway. I want this for him. There aren't any more croaking frogs, so I know he heard me. This kid has changed. I know you're paying attention, but look at him. He's in line to leap off a cliff, and I bet you anything he can't even swim. He turns and waves us over, like he's inviting us to a line for a roller coaster. Come on, Mateo says, eyeing me. Or we can go back to Make a Moment and swim around one of their pools if you want. I honestly think you'll feel better about everything if you get back in the water. Me coaching you through something is weird, right?
It's a little ass backward, yeah, I say.
I'll make it short. We don't need those Make a Moment stations and their virtual realities. We can make our own moment right here.
In this artificial rainforest? I smile back.
I made no claims to this place being real. The arena attendant tells Mateo he's next. Is it cool if my friends and I jump together? Mateo asks. Absolutely, she responds.
I'm not going, Lydia says.
Yes, you are, Mateo says. You'll regret it if you don't.
I should push you off the cliff, I tell Mateo. But I won't, because you're right.
I can take on my fear, especially in a controlled environment like this, with lifeguards and arm floaties. No one planned for a swim, so we stripped down to our underwear, and yo, I had no idea how damn skinny Mateo is. He avoids looking my way, which I find funny. Unlike Lydia, in nothing but her bra and jeans, who's looking me up and down. The attendants give us our gear. I'm calling the floaties gear because it sounds less cute, and we slip it on. The attendant tells us to jump when we're comfortable, which shouldn't be too long since a line is forming behind us.
Count of three?
Mateo asks.
Yeah.
One? Two? I grab Mateo's hand and lock my fingers in his. He turns to me with flushed cheeks and grabs Lydia's hand.
Three!
We all look ahead and below, and we jump. I feel like I'm falling through the air faster, dragging Mateo with me. Mateo shouts, and in the few seconds I have left before hitting the water, I shout too. And Lydia cheers. I hit the water, Mateo still beside me, and we're underwater for only a few seconds. But I open my eyes, and I see him there. He's not panicking, and it reminds me of how settled my parents looked after they set me up for freedom. Lydia has disconnected. She's already out of sight. Mateo and I float back to the top with our hands still locked, lifeguards flanking us. I move toward Mateo laughing, and I hug him for this freedom he's forced onto me. It's like I've been baptized or some shit, ditching more anger and sadness and blame and frustration beneath the surface, where they can sink to who cares where. The waterfall pummels the water around us, and a lifeguard ushers us to the hill. An attendant at the bottom of the hill offers us towels, and Mateo wraps his around his shoulders, shivering.
How do you feel?
He asks. Not bad, I say. We don't bring up the hand-holding or anything like that, but hopefully he gets where I'm coming from now, in case he had any doubts. We head on up to the top of the hill, drying ourselves with towels, and retrieve our clothes and get dressed. We exit through the gift shop, where I catch Mateo singing along with the song on the radio. I corner Mateo as he picks up one of the farewell cards offered here.
You made me jump, and now it's your turn.
I jumped with you.
Not what I'm talking about.
Come with me to this underground dance club place. Deckers go there to dance and sing and chill.
You down?
Officer Andrade, 4:32 p.m. Depcas did not call Ariel Andrade because he isn't dying today. But since he's an officer of the law, getting the call is his greatest fear every night when the clock strikes midnight. Especially since losing his partner 2 months ago. He and Graham could have been a buddy cop movie, the way they handled business and traded dad jokes over beers. Graham is always on Andrade's mind, and today is no exception with these foster kids in the holding cell who are acting out because their brother is a Decker. You don't need matching DNA for someone to be your brother. Andrade knows this. And you definitely don't need the same blood to lose a part of yourself when someone dies. Andrade doesn't believe the Decker Rufus Emeterio, who he stopped pursuing in the early morning hours, is going to be trouble, if he's even still alive. He's always had a sixth sense for Deckers who will spend their final hours creating chaos. Like the Decker responsible for Graham's death. On the day Graham received his alert, he insisted on spending his end day working. If he could die saving lives, it was a better way to go than one last lay. The officers were pursuing a Decker who was signing up for Bangers, the challenge for online feeds that has had a heartbreaking amount of daily hits and downloads the past 4 months. People tune in every hour to watch Deckers kill themselves in the most unique way possible, to go out with a bang. The most popular death wins the Decker's family some decent riches from an unknown source, but for the most part, it's just a bunch of Deckers who don't kill themselves creatively enough to please the viewers, and, well, you don't exactly get a second shot. Graham's attempts to prevent a Decker from riding his motorcycle off the Williamsburg Bridge only got himself killed. Andrade is doing his damn best to get that snuff channel terminated by the end of the year. No way in hell he can share a beer with Graham in heaven without getting this job done. Andrade wants to focus on his real work, not babysitting. That's why he has their foster parents signing release forms this very second. Let them go home with firm warnings so they can sleep. And grieve. Maybe even find their friend if he's still alive. If you're close enough to a Decker when they die, you won't be able to put words to anything for the longest time. But few regret spending every possible minute with them while they were still alive. Patrick Peck Gavin, 4:59 p.m.
Maybe he's dead already.
Peck has notifications turned on for Rufus's Instagram, but stays personally locked on anyway.
Come on, come on.
Peck wants Rufus dead, of course, but he wants to deliver the killing blow.
Rufus, 5:01 p.m. The line for Clint's graveyard isn't as long as it was last night when I was headed back to Pluto. Not even going to start speculating if this means everyone is inside or if they've gone and died already. It's got to be the greatest club, hands down, for Mateo. They better let me in, even though I don't turn 18 for another few weeks.
We're coming to a club at 5, Lydia says.
My phone goes off, and I'm banking on it being Amy, when I see Malcolm's dead-ass ugly profile pic.
The Plutos. Oh, shit.
Plutos? Lydia asks.
His best friends,
Mateo says, which doesn't really scratch the surface on who they are to me. But I let it slide because this is so wild even Mateo is tearing up for me. I bet I'd be the same way if his dad called him right now. I answer FaceTime, walking away from the line. Malcolm and Tego are together. Legit surprised I answered. They're smiling at me like they want to tag team bang me.
Roof!
Holy shit, I say. You're alive, Malcolm says. You're not locked up.
They can't hold us,
Tego says, fighting for space so he can be seen too.
You see us?
Screw all of this.
Roof, where you at?
Malcolm is squinting, looking beyond my head. I have no idea where they're at either.
I'm at Clint's.
I can give them a better goodbye. I can hug them.
Can you guys get here? Soon?
Making it past 5 has been a fucking miracle. But time is running out, no doubt. Mateo is holding Lydia's hand. And I want my best friends here, too. All of them.
Can you grab Amy, too?
Not that asshole Peck. I'll beat his ass again. If there was a lesson I was supposed to learn here, I didn't. Dude ruined my funeral and got my friends locked up. I get to deck him again. And don't try to tell me I'm wrong.
He's lucky you're still alive, Malcolm says. We'd be spending our night hunting him down if you weren't.
Don't leave Clint's, Tego says. We'll be there in 20 minutes, smelling like prison.
Funny how Tego swears he's a hardened criminal now. I'm not going anywhere. I'm here with a friend. Just get here, all right?
You better be there, Roof, Malcolm says.
I know what he's really saying. I better be alive. I take a photo of the sign for Clint's graveyard and upload it to Instagram in full color.
Patrick Peck, Gavin. 5:05 p.m. Got him, Peck says, hopping off his bed. Clint's graveyard. He puts the loaded gun in his backpack. We gotta be fast. Let's go.
Part 4. The End. No one wants to die. Even people who want to go to heaven don't want to die to get there. And yet death is the destination we all share. No one has ever escaped it. And that is as it should be, because death is very likely the single best invention of life. It is life's change agent. It clears out the old to make way for the new. Steve Jobs. Mateo, 5:14 p.m. This day has some miracles. I found a last friend in Rufus. Our best friends are joining us on our end day. We've overcome fears. And we're now at Clint's graveyard, which receives high praise online. And this could be the perfect stage for me if I outgrow my insecurities in the next few minutes. From all the movies I've seen, bouncers are normally stubborn in their ways and absolutely intimidating. But here at Clint's graveyard, there's a young woman wearing a fitted cap backward, welcoming everyone. The young woman asks for my ID. Sorry to lose you, Mateo. Have fun in there, okay? I nod. I drop some cash into a plastic donations container and wait for Rufus to pay his way in. The girl eyes him up and down, and my face heats up. But then Rufus catches up to me and pats my shoulder, and the burn is different, like when he grabbed my hand back at the Travel Arena. Music is booming from the other side of the door, and we wait for Lydia. You good? Rufus asks. Nervous and excited. Mainly nervous. Regret making me jump off a cliff yet? Do you regret jumping? No. Then no. Are you gonna have fun in there? No pressure, I say. There's a difference between jumping off a cliff and having fun. Once you jump off a cliff, there's no one doing it. There's no stopping midair. But having the kind of fun that seems daring and embarrassing in front of strangers requires a special bravery. There's no pressure, Rufus says. Just our last few hours left on this planet to die without any regrets. Again, no pressure. No regrets. He's right. My friends stand behind me as I pull open the door and walk into a world where I immediately regret not having spent every minute possible. There are strobe lights, flashing blues, yellows, and grays. The graffiti on the walls was marked by Deckers and their friends, sometimes the last piece of themselves the Deckers have left behind, something that